It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Two big local developments yesterday, both of which have been hanging fire for quite some time. First, the sentencing of Stuart Dunnings to a year in the Clinton County Jail. That will be followed by a few years of probation. 1 year is 1 year in jail. He begins serving his sentence Friday evening, according to the reports. Also, the four abandoned GM properties in and around Lansing have a buyer. North Point Development of Kansas City still needs to complete due diligence and formally seek approval for its projects. I'm getting an assist here from Steve Reed of the Lansing State Journal on this. But North Point intends to build a mix of manufacturing, warehouse, and distribution facilities, primarily for the automotive sector, and the plan could reportedly produce hundreds of jobs. North Point has developed more than 28 million square feet of industrial property in eight states total, and previously bought Racer Trust properties in Kansas City and in Lordstown, Ohio. It is never too late to expand the mind of a person on the autism spectrum. Our first guest today spoke those words. Dr. Temple Grandin is sometimes referred to as the best-known person with autism in the world. That's due to her renown in not one, but two fields. First, her groundbreaking work in animal welfare. She's best known for designing humane cattle handling facilities that are used for half the cattle in the United States. And second, her ongoing writing and advocacy for people like herself on the autism spectrum. Dr. Grandin's been in Lansing the last few days, speaking at gatherings about both autism and animal welfare. I sat down with her yesterday and first asked about a comment on her website. She writes about 1950s methods for teaching social skills that worked for me. I asked her what she meant.
Well, as a young autistic kid, in the 50s methods, instead of yelling and screaming at kids when they do something wrong, like bad table manners, they simply give the instruction. If I put my finger in the mashed potatoes, mother would say, use the fork. You give the instruction. You explain them how they should behave.
Were you suggesting that some approaches from decades ago have been abandoned and ought to be revived?
Well, in the 50s, kids were taught table manners in a much more structured way. I went to college with a lot of kids that I know are on the autism spectrum. When I was 4 years old, I had no speech. I was really severe. And then there's other kids that are just socially awkward. And they own businesses today, ones of my generation, because the social skills were taught in a much more structured manner.
Mm-hmm. You also write that excessive praise is bad for a young person on the autism spectrum. Why is that?
Well, it's bad for all kids. I was praised when I did a really exceptional art project, but I was not praised for being on time for school pickup. That was something that was simply expected.
Do adults commonly respond that way to an autistic child?
Well, the thing with autism is it goes all the way from Silicon Valley to Einstein, who had no language till age three. Thomas Edison probably was on the autism spectrum. And so you're going from somebody that's just socially awkward, super smart, that ought to be working for Google, to somebody who can't dress themselves. It's all called the same thing. I've been to NASA. Oh, you've got people on the spectrum there, and they've got autistic grandkids. See, a little bit of the trait gives you somebody who's super smart but socially awkward. Too much of the trait, you get much more handicaps.
But do you meet parents, or do you hear about parents who praise excessively a child on the spectrum?
Oh, yeah, and they also overprotect. I'm seeing smart 13-year-old kids that are fully verbal, that nobody's taught them how to shop. Just basic skills, things that I learned when I was seven.
We are talking with Dr. Temple Grandin while she's in East Lansing, the reformer, inventor, author. We're talking about autism, and we will be talking about animal welfare issues here in just a minute. You've also described the advantages that sensory therapies can have for young people on the spectrum. I guess the most common one is deep pressure therapy, or it's one of the most common.
It works for some, and it doesn't for others. See, the problem is autism is a spectrum. And I discussed this in my book, The Autistic Brain. Also in my book, Thinking in Pictures, I discuss, you know, experiences with pressure. Pressure works for some kids. It doesn't work for everybody, but there are some kids that respond well to that. Also, in my books, I talk about visual thinking. I'm a visual thinker. That helped me in my design work because I could visually think about how to design something. Other kinds of kids are mathematical minds. Other kids are word thinkers. Take the thing that the kid's good at and build on it.
But for our listeners who don't know what deep pressure therapy is, can you describe it?
Well, basically, it'd be something as simple as getting two cushions and just putting pressure on or a weighted vest. You know how the weighted x-ray apron feels?
Sure.
Some people find that kind of relaxing. Some kids really respond well to that. It works for some. It doesn't work for others.
Last year, a study out of the Drexel Autism Institute in Philadelphia found that 40% of people on the autism spectrum can't find work, despite perhaps very desirable skills that they might possess, analytical powers or any number of things. I'm curious what you make of that situation, the challenge of finding a job for a lot of people on the spectrum, and what you think might be done about that.
Let's talk about the 60% of the people that are fully, completely verbal, normal intelligence or greater. The big problem is not learning how to work. When I was 13, my mother got me a sewing job. When I was 15, I was cleaning 8 horse stalls every day. Then I went out to my aunt's ranch. And then I got career-relevant internships when I was in college, working in a research lab. One of the ways to improve the working is a kid needs to hold down 2 jobs, something like Walmart or McDonald's, before they graduate high school. So they learn working skills, getting to work on time. You've got to do it. And then they're going to find employment. Also, I worked with a lot of quirky, different kinds of guys in welding and in drafting when I worked with the big meatpacking plants. Okay, Cargill's one company where I have designed equipment for the front end of their beef plants all over North America. And I worked with guys in the shop that I know are on the spectrum. And you know what saved those guys? They took welding in high school. One of the worst things that schools have done is taken out all the hands-on classes, cooking, sewing, woodworking, art, theater, all these kind of things that can help the kids that are quirky and different to go into a career.
I want to ask you a question just from my own curiosity. I mean, you're old enough that you remember life before computers or
yes.
personal computers. I'm curious, did you adapt to computers and the digital life easily, or was that harder?
Well, when it comes to finding things online, I can outsurf the young ones. Very, very definitely. You know, my paper library skills went right over to Google just fine. But I'm concerned about the kids getting addicted to video games. And they're not having good outcomes. I'm hearing mom saying he's 21, he's playing video games 8 hours a day. That needs to be limited. The other thing I have learned about careers, students get interested in careers they get exposed to. I got interested in going into beef cattle because I was exposed to them when I was 15, when I went out to my aunt's ranch. And I was afraid to go to my aunt's ranch originally. My mother gave me a choice. I could go for a week or I could go all summer. Not going was not going to be one of the choices. We got to get these kids out of the house doing things.
Generally, would you say that people with autism are good with technology, or is it generally more of a challenge?
Well, it varies a whole lot. Mm. You know, I'm interested in getting these kids working, and they've got to learn social skills like being in a foreign country. It's got to be taught in a much more structured sort of way. And again, autism goes from people who work for Silicon Valley to somebody who can't dress themselves. So I don't want to be overgeneralizing about this.
You spent yesterday discussing animal welfare issues with a variety of people, including quite a few veterinarians here at Michigan State. What kind of animal welfare issues are veterinarians facing here in 2016?
Well, we'll talk yesterday. I talked a lot about the importance of stockmanship in handling livestock. It was a livestock talk. People always want the magical thing more than they want the management. And I've designed a lot of cattle handling facilities. And I've found over a 40-year career that selling the new facilities was easy. The more difficult thing was getting people to actually operate it correctly, the management side of it. You know, management is a whole lot of little details that add up to a big thing. And I talked about some scientific studies that show that good stockmanship, where cattle are low fear, are more productive cattle. I showed some tips on cattle handling, some handler movement patterns. If you're interested in this stuff, I've got a book called Humane Livestock Handling, lots of diagrams of how to move cattle, lots of stuff on my website, grandin.com, on handling cattle. That was some of the main stuff I talked about yesterday.
What welfare improvements have been made in recent years for animals that are raised for food?
One of the biggest is improvement at the slaughter plants. That is one part of the industry that has really improved. I've done a lot of work, especially with cattle and pig slaughter plants. You know, the bad old days back in the 80s, they were really, really bad. And then I was worked with McDonald's and Wendy's in around 1999, 2000, and I came up with a very simple way to audit animal welfare at slaughter plants. They had to make certain numbers, like no more than 3 cattle out of 100 mooing in the stunning area. They had to make their numbers, very simple, straightforward way of evaluating them. Handling has improved. That is one of the bright spots in animal welfare.
Give us another example in
well,
which...
Well, feed yard handling's gotten better. My student, Ruth Woliwode, went out to a whole bunch of feed yards in Kansas and Colorado and evaluated cattle handling. That had improved. Yeah, there's still some other welfare issues, but handling is one area where it's improved. It's not perfect, but compared to 20 years ago, it's light years better.
What is really important that you would say remains to be done? What's ahead of us here in terms of improving?
Well, like we were just out at the feed yard. We've got to make sure that we don't let cattle get lame. Let's look at some of the things we need to assess welfare on a feed yard or dairy, for example. A dairy body condition score. Don't let them get too skinny. All of the livestock, lameness. Many, many different things can make cattle lame and have sore feet and have difficulty walking. I can measure that. I want to keep that lameness at a very, very low level. If your animals are living inside, we've got to keep them clean. So that's bedding and management. That's another thing I'm going to look at. Swollen legs, I got to make sure that they're not getting swollen legs. Those are things that I can manage. Indoor animals keep ammonia levels in the building really low. Really simple things. In fact, I have a book, Improving Animal Welfare, Practical Approach, where we can look at simple things like lameness, and I want to keep it at a low level. Because if I measure that lameness, then I can tell, am I getting better or am I getting worse? You manage the things that you measure.
And you can point to, I mean, for animals that are raised for food or for dairy cattle, let's say.
All right.
If they're not experiencing lameness, is the resulting food higher quality? Can you draw a correlation to that?
Well, I can usually draw a correlation.
Or is it more of a humane?
It's humane, but it's also productivity. Lame animals are not going to be as productive.
What don't consumers know that you think maybe they ought to know about how animals are raised for food?
Well, Fair Oaks Farm outside of Chicago is doing an absolutely fabulous job. Have a great big, gigantic, huge dairy. It's open to the public so people can see what a big, huge commercial dairy looks like. They also have a pig farm that's open to the public. I think ag needs to be opening up the door and showing what they're doing. And Fair Oaks Farm is doing a wonderful job at this.
Hmm. What do you think are the biggest consumer misconceptions?
Well, one of them is big is bad. That's a common misconception. What I have found is badly managed is bad. And you can have badly managed in all different sizes of operations.
One component of your talks yesterday were involved the biological limits of animal production from an animal welfare perspective. Can you explain what that was about?
Well, you can push an animal genetically. I'm very concerned about leg conformation issues right now in cattle. That's genetic. Also, I'm concerned about animals like the bulldog. You've bred this animal, extreme animal. It has difficulty breathing, difficulty walking, has to have its puppies by cesarean. I think that's a big welfare issue. That's an example of genetically just pushing an animal too far. You could push it too far with a feed additive or just too high concentrate feed. You've got to be careful of not pushing the biology. Some of my biggest concerns right now today are genetic.
Do you have another book planned?
Well, I'm working on a book right now for livestock handling for small producers.
And when do you expect that to come
out? That'll come out in the spring.
And talk to us about your position at Colorado State. Is it a good place to be on the faculty?
No, Colorado's a beautiful, beautiful place. I've got graduate students, and one of the problems they're having is they don't want to leave Colorado because it is beautiful. And I've been doing a lot of different kinds of things. One study that one of my students worked on was to look at temperament differences in mama cows and how they protect their calves. And some moms are great mothers and call the calf and protect it. And others, there's a few that walk away from it. That's not something you'd want to have.
We've been talking with Dr. Temple Grandin while she's in East Lansing. We've been talking with her about autism and animal welfare issues. Enjoy your visit to East Lansing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hee 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 hee.
And coming up on Current State, Neighbors in Action. We'll check in with the Refugee Development Center to learn more about how they help refugees resettle here in Lansing and how you might get involved. That's later this hour on Current State. Well, with Thanksgiving marking the start of the traditional holiday season, we're entering the peak time for charitable giving. In recent weeks, one of Lansing's largest homeless services providers has received a few unexpected gifts. Volunteers of America, Michigan is using nearly a ton of meat and donated kitchen and dining equipment to serve hundreds of clients each day. Current State's Kevin Lavery toured the VOA shelter in downtown Lansing this week to learn more about the people who are giving and receiving this time of year. That's where he met kitchen manager Jeff Ramirez, who affectionately goes by the moniker Chef Jeff.
Let me take you back where the magic starts.
That sounds great.
Way back. Yeah.
So our dining room kind of changed forces over the last 60 days. We got tables and chairs donated from Sparrow. We got a new hotline and cold line with sneeze guards and all the works, everything I could ask for. You know, I mean, 5 wells for hots, you know, 10 wells for cold. And it's just one of those amazing things that you're just grateful for everything that you get for all the donations. You know, I got places I can put to-go fruit, vegetables, take it home. If I can't use it back there, I'd rather give it away, let them be able to use it at home.
About how many folks do you serve a day? Is this typical right now, Jeff?
This is kind of light. As it goes on, it'll get fill up a little bit more. I typically average about 400 meals a day. Is a good roundabouts numbers, you know, plus or minus, you know, 30. But it just is, it's one of those things where it's just like, if you build it, they will come, you know, type of deals. And I try to put it, you know, I mean, my whole emphasis into it is I want to provide something better. And actually, I got to go get the veggie out.
As Jeff steps away to attend to his duties, I step outside the dining room to the end of the line where I meet Gerald Mason. His striking eyes shine through his dark complexion, his speech conveying a hint of his Jamaican ancestry. Gerald has been at the VOA shelter about 6 months, but he's been chronically homeless more than 3 years.
It basically means you never know what's gonna or where you're gonna lay your head, you know. Wherever you lay your head usually expire over a period of time. Whether it's people, whether it's in a hotel, whether it's you know, somebody who think, okay, I'll help you out. But it can only last for so long. You know, and I've become somewhat good at it. However, it always seemed to end up at the same thing. I have nowhere to go that's secured and that I'm able to maintain. And this is what I'm working at now.
Any long-term friends or family who's a support network for you?
Not in this area, because I've relocated from Chicago, you know, and I've been here now since 2015, September, and I've been here and there, pick up little jobs here and there, but it wasn't mainly something that would have taken me through to get me my own place. This is what VOA is helping me for now, and they're putting me on the road. I've been allowed to get a voucher. I'm working on getting the full, not only the monthly payment, but the security, and they're helping me here and showing me to other places where they probably help me with the deposit, and that would be able to put me in a permanent place for at least a year, and then from there I can take it as far as getting work or getting in form of assistance I need to maintain a permanent place.
Back in the kitchen, Chef Jeff takes me behind the scenes to an industrial freezer. Everything in it is donated, and Jeff says he often doesn't know when it's coming until he hears the knock on the back door. He displays his wares like a prized collection.
My chicken's over here, my pork over here, hot dogs there, you know, I mean, the pizzas, you know, wherever I can put them. You know, I get prime rib from Outback Steakhouse. You know, it has a little fat cap, but it just, we're gonna trim it away using those knife skills to harvest a nice chunk of meat, feed prime rib to my clients. And that's the best part about it, is I I look at the bare bones and I'm like excited about cooking it, you know, and that's what drives me every day is just to be able to provide great meals.
The smile has not left your face since I walked up to you just now and shook your hand. I mean, and you just told me what motivates you. I mean, you know, not everybody in your position might have such a positive attitude when they see day after day people who are struggling. I mean, does it get on your psyche?
It does. You know what I mean? When I see that family come in and they just got evicted, they have nowhere to go, it gets me sad inside, but my position allows me to help them. So I feed them 3 hot meals every day. And I can show them where to go. You know what I mean? And the people that we have here is a great team of people to be able to provide housing and be able to know the government agencies that we need to fill out this paperwork, that paperwork, and make our clients do the things that they need to get done to be able to get them into a house. You know what I mean? There isn't a reason why we should have this bad of poverty level that we do have, but it's that follow through. You know what I mean? Knowing where to go, knowing who's going to help, who's going to help me get into a house. You know what I mean? And this is a great organization, and I love it. You know what I mean? Because we house them, and they come through, and they're like, I got an apartment. And I always give them high fives. It's a great day, you know, when I see them get housed. And it just, you know what I mean? I say, hey, come visit me when you get there. And I give them a bag of groceries to take home for their first bag of groceries for the house. You know, and it's one of those things where I'm happy for them when they make that turning point.
Gerald Mason's turning point may be nearby. I'd like to know what he plans to do once he's reached it, so I ask him. Gerald, what's your passion? What do you enjoy in life? What's your dream for the rest of your life?
That's a big, big question. Well, my birthday dream right now, I'll tell you really at the background, is after I've attained a certain amount of stability, to turn around and see who I could help who is going through and has gone through what I'm going through. I mean, you know, it's a lesson in itself. However, in two phases, I'm a spiritual person. You know, I know this is not necessarily a spiritual interview. However, the fact that a power greater than myself is looking out and directing me, you know, and helping me if I only seek that and try to generate that relationship, that's where the strength comes from. Not giving up or going back to the previous life I used to live, but seek the further thing. And I tell you, man, it's real. And I'd like to transmit that message to others who are going through it, whatever they're going through, if they keep that spiritual contact, relationship, they will find, you know, the eventual thing. And whoever might be listening and hearing this, it is no doubt that if you keep your faith and seek a power greater than yourself, they will help you. But just don't give up. Sooner or later, the light will be at the end of the tunnel.
I think I'm probably keeping you from a meal, so let's get you in line, huh?
Thank you very much, and I do appreciate you choosing me, and those that hear me, just keep on trying to do it, the right thing, next right thing, and the right thing will happen.
Gerald, best of luck to you. Wonderful meeting you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, and same to you all.
As Gerald makes his way through the serving line, I seek out Jeff Ramirez again. It's then that I learn that the chef and his customer share a bond, and it's not the universal human affinity for good food.
Had my own turmoils in my own life to allow me to go from where they were, you know, because I had no house at one point 3 years ago. So I understand that, you know, I mean, you have to go to somebody. You can't rely on yourself all the time. So you have to humble yourself and be like, I need help. And that's the first problem is you can't do it alone. You know what I mean? Everybody needs help at some point in their life. If it's just someone to talk to or someone to say, hey, you should go in that direction. And that's the best thing about this place is that most of us know what direction you guys need to go, you know, as a client. And you know me, my job is to make sure everybody's full and everybody gets to sleep good at night, you know, and just got that warm belly, you know.
Chef Jeff surveys the warm bellies and smiling faces that come through his dining room. He confides that if he had it his own way, Jeff would call his little niche on Larch Street Lansing's Love Kitchen.
You know, because you could just look out there and you could just see changes, you know what I mean? From the time that they come in the door and they're hungry to the time they leave the door is like You know, I mean, I try to bring that sense into bringing that flavor that they had when they were a child, and bringing some of that, you know, I mean, original classic cooking that they can remember, and bringing those good memories back as we get into this festive holiday.
You can really see a physical and even emotional transformation from the time they walk in the line to the time they walk out the door. You can see that.
I can see that. You can see that every day. And that's the best sparkle of my day, is that comfort of knowing that they enjoyed the meal, that they say that this is the best place on the block to go get dinner at. You know, competing against, you know, I mean, all the other restaurants around the area. And you
can't beat the price either.
I can't. You know, man, this is one of those days that I come to work every day and I say, are you hungry? I don't get to charge you nothing. And that's great.
On Thanksgiving Day, Volunteers of America will not be serving turkey with all the trimmings. For that tradition, the staff defers to a local Catholic parish, St. Gerard's. Tomorrow, a local transportation company will bus the shelter's clients to the church celebration. But VOA Executive Vice President Patrick Patterson says his team is already gearing up for its next big holiday service project.
Well, Thanksgiving always overlaps with Christmas. You know, you get one done and start on the next. The long hallowed tradition here is our Christmas meal program, where we have delivered Christmas meals to shut-ins as long as anybody remembers, back to the 50s. And so this is a terrific tradition, all volunteer run. It's in the works already. And we've got some wonderful volunteer leaders who have led that program through the ages. And so what we'll do is, from scratch, we will prepare 500, 600 Christmas dinners. Those will be boxed up. Volunteer drivers will come pick them up. Volunteers will route those folks. Volunteers will handle all of the application and communication process. It's just a great example of our namesake.
The Volunteers of America Michigan office in Lansing will end 2016 with pride and begin 2017 with optimism. Looking back, the staff received 43 new homeless veterans in the span of 6 months, and 43 have since been housed. Looking forward, the VOA soon hopes to add another vital service to its portfolio, a community dental clinic. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Coming up on Current State, yesterday, MSU's Chef Kurt Kwiatkowski, gave us some hints for cooking Thanksgiving dinner. Today, Current State's Brooke Allen takes a tour around WKAR Radio and asks the staff what their favorite Thanksgiving dishes are. Some of their answers may surprise you. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan has long been a home to refugees from around the world. For our Neighbors in Action segment this week, we talk with an organization that helps refugees that land in the Lansing area adjust to life in America. To talk with us about that, we welcome back Erica Brown-Binion, the Executive Director of the Refugee Development Center in Lansing. Erica, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
I want to talk about your new location. That must feel like kind of a new lease on life, or a new chapter, I suppose. Where are you? What's that been like?
Absolutely. We are located in the Neighborhood Empowerment Center now, which is on the old campus of the School for the Blind. So there's a few other nonprofits in the area, the Housing Coalition, Mid-Michigan Guardianship Services. There's a lot of collaboration happening. The building is absolutely beautiful, with artwork all over. It feels like you're in an art gallery, a beautiful, welcoming place for our newcomers to walk in and feel like home.
How many
people do you help through the course of a year, let's say?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And in fact, it changes every year. We were just looking at the data, and in 2008, which is as far back as I could find, we were serving about 200 people a year. And the numbers this year are already over 2,200 people.
Mm-hmm. What's the heart of the services that you offer, if you can define it that way?
Absolutely. No, we absolutely can, because that's our mission. It's education. It's providing education and social support services to refugees once they're resettled here. Resettlement support only lasts about 90 days, and there's really this gap in the ability for people to learn about the neighborhood, learn about the community, learn English, and really feel like they belong here. And that's our mission, and that's our goal. And everyone's on a different spectrum of needs. So some people just need support for a couple months, and some people a couple years. And that is our goal. There's no timeline on our services. There's no exit time that people have to leave. It's open entry, open exit for the time of a length of time anybody needs that education piece.
Do you know how many of the people you help end up staying in Lansing long term, or 5 years,
right,
or more,
right,
that kind of thing?
That's actually a really good question too, and something we look at a lot. We find that Lansing is a safe and welcoming community, and people really do stay here. We certainly don't track in and out, but we estimate that there's about 20,000 refugees that have landed in the Lansing area since the 70s and have really remained. So even with some of the people who leave, those that our second migrants that come here after they were resettled in another place. We get a lot of people who stay here. Lansing's mid-sized. There's decent housing stock, decent jobs that people can find. It's reliable transportation for people that utilize it. So it's a place that people feel safe and want to stay here.
You sound so optimistic about what you do. But I have to ask, mm-hmm, do you feel like you are able to deliver, mm-hmm, to the refugee community in Lansing everything, mm-hmm, they need? Mm-hmm. Or, along with the other services that are available, do you feel like Lansing does a good job of serving these newcomers?
Certainly. That's the challenge we face every day, to make sure, are we doing our due diligence? Are we doing the best job that we can do? I think one of the most amazing things about the Lansing community is that it's truly collaborative. There are several agencies. There are the faith communities. There are St. Vincent Catholic Charities. There's the school district, several agencies that are working collaboratively, and in fact meet monthly at the IRRC, which is the Immigrant and Refugee Resource Collaborative, part of Ingham County's Power of We. And that's an opportunity to share challenges that we're all facing and find ways to fill gaps. So I feel like as a single entity, the RDC cannot fill all those needs. But as a community, we really work hard to make sure that those gaps are filled and people are getting the services that they need and deserve, and so that they can be on that path to self-sufficiency and success.
We're talking with Erica Brown Binion here on Current State's Neighbors in Action. Erica is the director of the RDC, as she refers to it, the Refugee Development Center here in Lansing, which provides support and education for newly arrived refugees in the Lansing area. When a family first arrives here, what's that first week or two like? What are their most immediate needs?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So St. Vincent Catholic Charities is the resettlement agency, and they will meet someone at the airport, take them to their first home or apartment, get them their first meal, kind of show them around their neighborhood, take them to medical appointments. An incredible challenge, and you can imagine a couple years ago in the ice storm where people are arriving from a warm climate.
Oh my word! And I can't even imagine that.
And maybe had flip flops on. So that first week is really just about orientation to this Michigan climate, the Midwest.
The natives couldn't deal with it. How in the world are refugees going to be able to contend with that?
We are always doing winter coat drives and warm wool socks to pass out to people. people. But those first few weeks are really a challenging time, and usually the time that people remember very, very vividly, exactly how they felt and what the sun was like. I remember my first experience at the RDC was teaching ESL, and my first group of students was actually a large family. There were 5 kids and the 2 adults, and they filled up my whole class. And I remember in April, they said, "Teacher, I don't understand. The snow when I arrived is still the snow that's there now. How come it never leaves?" And I said, "I promise it'll go away soon, but you're right. It was one of those years where the snow just never melted."
It was a lesson in climatology,
exactly,
is what it was.
Yeah.
How often are the arrivals parents with children, though? It's easy to assume that's a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm, very frequently.
Yeah.
Not always both parents, but often families that we resettle here in the Lansing area are two-parent families and at least one parent.
Lansing is known as a hub for refugee resettlement in Michigan. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think back in the late 70s, the Lansing community decided that they would be a welcoming community and be a resettlement city. St. Vincent was established here and started resettling refugees then. And it's been one of those opportunities to grow a population at a time when we're losing population. A lot of times when refugees are resettled here, they set roots and they want to stay. They build businesses, they're entrepreneurs, they're homeowners, they're taxpayers. They are contributing members of this community, and it's been a good thing for Lansing.
Are there specific areas or regions, parts of the world, where a lot of refugees in Lansing come from?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question because it's different all over. For example, in Detroit, it might be primarily Arabic-speaking.
Right.
Lansing is a plethora of countries that we see. So just the last couple of years, it's been Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Burma, Bhutan, Afghanistan, Iraqi. So you can see a wide range of people from all over the world, several languages and cultures.
You have seen some number of new Americans arrive, and you've watched them relaunch their lives. It must be something to witness. You shared one great story here just a minute ago. Is mm-hmm. there a family or another individual that stands out in your memory?
There's several. I mean, I could pick from a lot, but
I'm sure
there's a great story of a family that we have worked with for 3 or 4 years now. And they arrived here in the middle of winter, and Dad got sick pretty quickly. He had a very aggressive form of cancer. That was such a challenge for this family. He passed away, but Mom never stopped coming to English classes. The kids kept coming to our after-school programs and our summer camp, and they never gave up. Watching that determination was pretty amazing. And this summer, one of the kids was moving on to high school, and that was going to be a big step. So we called them up and said, "We'd like to do a school tour with you and at least get you to know what this big high school is going to look like." And Mom said, in English, which was amazing. She didn't speak any English when she arrived. She said, "I'm going to meet you there because I just got my license and I bought a car." And we were just so proud. I mean, tears of joy that just said, you've made it in some way. And she was just so proud to be able to do that for herself and be self-sufficient in that way.
To be sure.
Yeah.
That's terrific. Talk to us about the organization's needs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have what you would say are acute needs, or are you doing a good job? What's on your wish list?
Yeah, that's a great question too. One of the big things that we are working on right now is in our new space, building out an area that's going to be a drop-in learning center. So a mobile computer lab, a resource center for newcomers to access services as needed. There really isn't anything like that right now in the area, and we're really excited to take that next step. We had one long ago, and the building that we were in no longer served that purpose because our staff grew too big and the space wasn't accessible anymore. So we're excited to reopen that, and it's going to take some funding, so we're looking to build that out right now. But and then you know, more acutely is winter gear, which we're helping pass out. We just had a family who had one pair of shoes that were broken, and I put out a request, and I can't tell you how many boots showed up on our porch the next day.
Terrific.
So yeah, we have a lot. This community has really stepped up and is here to support newcomers, and we've seen that outpouring of support in the last several weeks, which has been amazing.
We just have 30 seconds, but Talk to us about volunteer opportunities. Do you have any?
Excellent. We have tons of volunteer opportunities. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up because our next volunteer orientation is December 12th at our new center. I believe it starts at 5 o'clock, but you can check out our website. We have orientation opportunities 3 times a year and lots of opportunities for people to get involved and work directly with our newcomer population.
Erica Brown-Binion is Executive Director of the Refugee Development Center in Lansing, the RDC. We've been talking about its programs for refugees and their upcoming Thanks Lansing event. Erica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
And same to you. Current states looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Well, Thanksgiving is a time to watch a little football, maybe hang out with the family, and with any luck, enjoy a wonderful dinner. Current State's Brooke Allen decided to find out what that favorite dish is for everyone here at WKAR.
Okay, Kevin Lavery, tell me your favorite Thanksgiving dish.
I'm a pretty simple guy. I like homemade mashed potatoes.
Real butter?
Absolutely. Is there any other way to go?
Probably not.
I know I should be dieting, but it's Thanksgiving, and we're not going to talk about that right now.
Thank you. All right, Scott Poole, tell me your favorite Thanksgiving dish.
I would have to say stuffing. I really like stuffing, maybe primarily because that's most likely the only time of the year you're ever going to really get real stuffing that's been inside a bird.
You know, you're not supposed to do that.
Not supposed to put it inside the bird?
No.
Why not?
Because they say it's bad for you.
Well, everything about the Thanksgiving meal is probably bad for you. That's why we only do it once a year.
Exactly. So do you make the stuffing in your house?
Oh, I make nothing that we actually eat. There's a good chance I'll carve the turkey. Other than that, I stay out of the way. And I'll do the cleanup after.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh
that's,
yeah.
That's huge. Can you come to my house afterwards?
No, but thank you.
What's up? Hi, Drew Henderson. You want to tell me your favorite Thanksgiving dish?
Sausage rolls.
What are those?
They're just sausage with puff with puff pastry around it. Yeah. My grandparents from England used to make that all the time in sausage stuffing. So it was big British Thanksgiving in the United States.
Oh, so it's kind of a family tradition.
Kind of, yeah.
Oh, and do you make those?
Not anymore since I stopped eating sausage and went vegetarian. So I don't really enjoy much Thanksgiving food. I usually just eat hummus and vegetables and maybe a little bit of stuffing, but a lot of that has chicken stock in it. And I have a intolerance for chicken, so I just don't feel good. So anyway, so everybody always wonders, like, what do you eat, you know, Thanksgiving? And that's what I eat, hummus. And oh, and the desserts are great.
So you do have some enjoyment on Thanksgiving.
My wife will be making a pumpkin cheesecake, which she always does, and it's great.
I am so coming over to your house for pumpkin cheesecake.
All right, I'll bring you some.
All right, Mr. Brad Walker, what's your favorite Thanksgiving dish?
Is this thing on?
Okay. Testing, 1, 2.
You're going to think I'm really strange. Not that you don't anyway, but it's cranberry sauce in a can. That is my favorite thing of Thanksgiving. I love that dish. No, I'm serious, too. I love it.
That's not a dish, Brad.
Yeah, it is. You said it on a dish. It's a dish. I do. I love it.
You said it on a dish after you pry it out of the can.
No, it's very easy. You just turn the can upside down and it goes boom, right onto the dish. It's a beautiful thing. I love it.
I'm walking out of your office now. All right, Mark Bayshore, I want to know what your favorite Thanksgiving dish is.
You know, Thanksgiving is the only time all year that I give myself permission to eat gravy. I mean, I am such a killjoy at the table. I just don't indulge myself enough at the table. But Thanksgiving's the one time a year when I actually have a tablespoon or two of gravy. So I'm gonna say gravy. You know, it's one little thing to look forward to. I like the whole thing. I like the ice cream with the pie for dessert. That's really cool.
So on Thanksgiving, you'll really be living it up.
Well, for me, yeah, I'll be living it up. No, it's Thanksgiving. Who doesn't like Thanksgiving? It's all good.
Okay, Jamie Paisley, I need to know what your favorite Thanksgiving dish is.
Mine, I would have to say it's my family sort of recipe. It's not part of Thanksgiving proper, but it's actually a bit of a breakfast food. It is called hoy, or at least that's what we called it from the, you know, borderline South. It is a chocolate gravy that you pour over biscuits, and it's like the Thanksgiving morning tradition.
Oh, so it's more of a morning thing to start you off.
It is, because, you know, you're not going to have enough sugar later on, so you might as well pile it on early in the morning.
And do you make this yourself?
Oh, yeah. Low and slow. It's like a barbecue sort of recipe, and otherwise it congeals a bit too much with the flour and the roux mixture.
Maybe we should post that recipe online.
I'd have to check my sources whether or not that's permissible.
All right. Okay, Al Martin, current sports host. What is your favorite Thanksgiving dish?
Wow. Hold on, because I have like three of them, but if I had to choose one, probably macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
I love some mac and cheese. My grandmother has like this original recipe that like has gone through the Martin history, and it is. And then a close second is sweet potato pie, but macaroni and cheese takes the cake.
Do you make it?
Oh, yeah, right. Stop. She won't even tell me the recipe. It's like a family secret. She only select few know that recipe, but I can barely bake chicken, let alone make some macaroni and cheese, Brooke. So, yeah, that has to be it, though, right there.
Okay, Peter Wharf, station manager, I need to know your favorite Thanksgiving dish.
Cornbread dressing, Southern style.
And do you make that?
No. No. No, Southern style. So I'm from here.
So what does Southern style mean?
I don't know, people in Michigan don't really, people from Michigan, as far as I know, don't really make cornbread dressing. It's, you know, I mean, think about it. Cornbread, traditional Southern staple at any meal. You use the old cornbread just as you would, you know, day-old bread to make a stuffing, but in this case it's a cornbread stuffing, and it's delicious. Sometimes it's with sausage, which, you know, that makes everything better. But the funny thing was, I heard my mother-in-law talking, who's from Memphis, Tennessee. This is where this is coming from. And she said, you know what the secret to great cornbread dressing is, stuffing? I said, no, I don't know. You tell me. She said, celery. Lots of celery. So
there it is.
Go figure. Who knew the secret to cornbread stuffing was celery, but that's it. And you use the leaves.
Of the celery?
Yes.
Okay, Jody Knoll, what's your favorite Thanksgiving dish?
I love pie, and I like pumpkin pie, but we usually have pecan pie too, and I love pecan pie.
Okay, so I have to ask, do you like it warm or cold?
Warm, with vanilla ice cream.
Cup of coffee?
Absolutely. Very dark.
My kind of guy. Thank you, Jody. Okay, Katie Cook, what is your favorite Thanksgiving dish?
I mean, this is so boring, but it's the turkey. I like the dark meat turkey. It's my favorite part.
You are the first person who has said turkey.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's just so good. I look forward to it every year.
And the dark meat?
It's more flavorful.
I give you the prize this year. You are the first one and the only one who has said turkey.
That's really funny. Great. Good.
So, Mark, out of all those answers, Kevin Lavery was the only one who said mashed potatoes were his favorite dish.
Only one turkey and only one mashed potatoes.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So what do you think is the hardest dish to cook out of all of those?
Oh, my gosh. I'd probably say the turkey.
Okay, so turkey is kind of the most difficult because it could end up much, you know, more dry. But actually, mashed potatoes are the most difficult. So when I spoke to MSU's Chef Kurt, he told me that the trick to making the most delicious mashed potatoes are actually using a potato ricer, Well, I've never heard of a potato ricer, so I went out and bought one the other day, and I made the potatoes with a potato ricer the other night, and then Chef Kurt came in, and he tried them out, and he had to fix them a little bit, and then everyone...
Just a little bit.
And you had a taste.
I did.
You tried them. And so the video is going to be posted on WKAR.org and our current state Facebook page of the incident.
The potato incident.
And everyone's reviews of those. So happy Thanksgiving, Mark. Thank you so much.
Same to you, Brooke. And if you only had to fix them a little bit, then I'm sure it speaks highly of your skills as well.
And so, very tasty.
Happy Thanksgiving. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we will have a Thanksgiving Day special for you. Friday, it's a Best of Current State show, so we can take a little bit of a break. We'll be back with a live show on Monday, including State Representative Gary Glenn, who is opposed to comprehensive Michigan energy legislation that the Michigan House will begin considering on Tuesday. That's coming up here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. Anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts, we wish everybody a wonderful break, a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we'll be back on Monday here on 90.5 WKAR.